This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Basis, that's my home, that's where I'm coming from. But I'm a citizen of the world, and I have influences from the rest of the world. And so if there's an aesthetic of another kind of a genre from another part of the world, like Fado, instrumental music from Portugal, or Tuareg, rhythms and phrases from the Sahara Desert of Africa, if I like them, I incorporate them into my music. And so I'm doing Indian contemporary music is how I say it.
Great. We'll talk more about your collaborations and dual cultures a little bit later in the program. But I am curious, how did you develop an interest in this style of music and ghazals from such a young age?
I think it was because both of my parents were ghazal singers. So they learned music, and they were singing this form of poetry, ghazal. They were singing this all the time. They were hobby. It was a very passionate hobby for them, a very serious hobby for them, in that they were not career musicians, but they took music very seriously. And they would have parties in India where like-minded friends would gather, and everyone would sit before dinner and sing a ghazal. So as a child, I was surrounded by this song form, and the words, the poetry of ghazal, it's a very deep literary type of poetry, and it is beyond the understanding of a child. It's not usual to have children listening to ghazals, but for some reason, I've just, right from the get-go, have always been mesmerized by this, the lilting melodies of this song form. And also, I might add, also of the upbeat rhythms of Punjabi folk songs. And so just as a child, I was surrounded by it, and it never left me.
Well, talking more about your collaborations, the song we heard in the introduction is called Rakaba, and this is a collaboration with the Tuareg group Terakaft. And you mentioned before that you collaborate with a number of artists, such as Tenaderwin, this Malian blues group, Cape Breton fiddler Natalie McMaster, your husband Reza Bassi, who is a jazz guitarist. Talk more about these collaborations and how it plays into this love poetry that is the ghazal.
Right.
Because my understanding is that the poetic form was strict and rarely deviates from its classical form.
Yeah, you're right. It is quite strict. When I was collaborating with a Fado musicians from Portugal for my previous CD, Wanderlust, it was a little easier because I think Fado is the equivalent of the Fado of Portugal is the equivalent of the ghazal of India. They're both genres of longing, of yearning. So it worked in an easier fashion. When I was collaborating and making songs, composing songs for the Tuareg of the African Sahara, it was much harder, and it was hard to find pre-written ghazal poems that would lend themselves to the musical vision that I had. Rakba is one that I did find. It's the lyrics, the poetry is written by a Canadian-based writer who was born in Pakistan, brought up in Canada. Not brought up in Canada, but immigrated to Canada. His name is Rafi Raza, and it was a rare find. I found it and was able to compose it in a way that the vision that I had for Tuareg electric guitars to fit in and the djembe to fit in. And then for my other compositions, because I was having trouble finding poetry to fit my vision, I was kind of forced to pick up the pen and write my own words, which aren't ghazal, but this is why I say it's contemporary Indian song is a lot of it. Because I had a musical vision first, and then came the poetry. And then for Tenaderwin, which is the other Grammy Award-winning Tuareg group, they're such a legendary band. I thought I would do a classic not a ghazal, but a song from another poetic genre, and that genre is called qawwali. That was made famous in the West. This genre was made famous in the West by Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. And then there's a traditional qawwali that he made famous called Mast Mast. And I thought it would be just really neat to take this song from the Sufi mystic tradition from Pakistan, where it's sung with acoustic instruments, harmonium and tabla, and take it and transport it and have it be sung by me, a woman, and Muslims from the Sahara Desert in Africa with electric guitars and electric bass. I thought it would be offering something new to people who already knew the song and something totally fresh to me, and it would be interesting for people who didn't know anything about the song. And I just thought, besides all of that rationalization, I just thought that the aesthetics would be really great.
It is a wonderful, wonderful, fun song that is guaranteed to get people up and dancing. And later in the program, we will hear the track Must Must, which you were just talking about.
And we were up and dancing while we were recording it.
That is true. It's on the video. This particular track, this particular qawwali, I've heard a couple of other renditions of it. And I was wondering, is there something about this particular song, let's say, that lends itself to experimentation?
I haven't really heard many experimentations myself of it. I had only heard the traditional version. Excuse me. And also, I should say, the version that Nusrat sang and then Michael Brooks from the Peter Gabriel label Real World, what Michael Brooks did with it to bring it out into the West. So those were the only renditions that I had heard of it. And in terms of, you know, having something particular that would speak to them, there were a number of qawwalis like this one that I was mulling over, which one should I choose? And in the end, I just liked, you know, everything, the rhythm and the melody of this one.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. In addition to ghazals, you also sing Punjabi folk songs, which is part of what we're hearing right now. One of my favorites of your Punjabi folk song repertoire is called Meri Gori Gori from your 2003 album Beyond Boundaries, which won your first Juno Award for Best World Music Album. And before we dive into that discussion, I did want to play this clip for our listeners. So that was a Punjabi folk song called Meri Gori Gori, and Punjab is a northern state located in India and Pakistan and split by a political border, we'll say. So first, tell us about the song, what the lyrics mean, and then tell us what the song means to you.
Right. Well, the song is about a girl in the villages of Punjab, and she is talking to her beloved, and she is describing her wrist to her beloved, and she's holding up her wrist and she's saying, "My fair and lovely wrist is rather bare." And so this is a hint to her lover to go to the market to buy her some bangles. And yeah, not a watch, but just some bangles. And here are my bangles, by the way. Ooh, there you go. I've got my bangles. So she's asking for some yellow bangles, but I think she really wants some 24-karat gold bangles. And what the song means to me, well, I think it's like the ghazals that I sing are, I mentioned they're like a deeper poetry of longing and yearning and melancholy and finding solace in the melancholy. And then I've always found that then balancing it with a nice peppy Punjabi folk song, which is much, much lighter, you know, just talking about simple things like wanting to be adorned by your beloved with some glass jewelry bangles. I find that, you know, it has a nice balance for me.
Excellent. You're listening to Stage and Studio, and I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts. If you missed any of this show, you can hear it again on stageandstudio.org. I'm talking with Kiran Ahluwalia, two-time Juno Award-winning ghazal singer, who joins me today by phone from Seattle. Kiran is giving her debut performance in Portland Wednesday night, which is tomorrow, April 24th, at the Alberta Rose Theater at 8 p.m. We were just discussing your work with ghazals and Punjabi folk songs, and your music represents a pretty vast variety of diversity in South Asia. So that being said, I was curious when earlier you were talking about growing up with two cultures, various cultures really, labels can become a nuisance. Do you ever struggle with how your music is received or categorized?
Yeah, struggle all the time with it, really. It is a struggle, basically. You know, the other day when we had a show here in Seattle, I had a write up in the Seattle Times, and the subheading was Kiran sings Persian ghazal, and for people who don't know the music of that region of the East. To them, you know, if you do a quick Wikipedia search, it will tell you that the ghazal, the form that I sing, originated in the 10th century in Persia. So that's accurate. It originated there. But after 400 years, four centuries, when it came to India and evolved in India, it is a completely different beast. It's not a Persian ghazal anymore. I'm singing Indian ghazal. And that, too, I'm not singing a traditional type that was sung in the 14th century. I'm singing a very 2013 kind of a ghazal. So, yes, there is a struggle to get your music accurately defined, but it's an area of the world that people in the West don't know about. And so for them, if you're getting a writer or anybody who has got, you know, four stories on the go and they have limited amount of time to get things right, it becomes a struggle for them as well to figure out how to decipher all the information that's in front of them.
Absolutely. And I was curious, you mentioned that your parents are also ghazal singers. Mm-hmm. How does your style compare with theirs? Do they practice a more traditional form or a classical form, or how does it compare?
Their form is definitely very traditional. My mother, the way she used to sing, the way she used to just throw her voice out, it's reminiscent of a time when they would be singing without microphones. And so if you're not singing with a microphone, your voice has to project differently above the other instruments, above the audience. And it was a completely different style of singing in terms of just the vocalization and how you do it. And the voice culture was very different. And, of course, they were heavy-duty music students, so they learned from their teachers. And then they sang things back like that. Whereas for myself, for many, many, many years now, I took what I learned, and then I was also much more into creation. So creating and composing my own compositions, and beyond compositions, creating a different style of incorporating other aesthetics and influences from other parts of the world. So my style is completely different from theirs. Yeah, but the basis of it is where they came from. That's where I started
and created it into a 2013 rendition. Diverting a little bit from our discussion about the music itself, as a touring artist, I'm sure you have many fascinating and challenging stories from the road. And in fact, last year you were in Timbuktu for a major world music festival at the time of many of the political uprisings in Mali. I know you have a story from that experience, so tell us about it.
Right. Well, so I collaborated with Tuareg musicians, and they come from the Sahara Desert. And in the Sahara, there is a centuries-old music festival, Tuareg Music Festival, that happens. And about 12 years ago, they opened up this music festival to foreigners, people from outside of Africa or outside of the Sahara Desert. And for 12 years, Europeans and North Americans have been going there. And I was invited to go there in January 2012, last year. And I really, really wanted to go, even though I was afraid of the porta-potty situation in the desert. But I was willing to brave it. And then, you know, apart from the toilet situation, there was that secondary concern of people having been kidnapped in Mali. But that was just secondary for me. So I was talking with various people, the Canadian consulate, because that's my passport, I am Canadian. And the Canadian consulate was telling me not to come, do not come, we cannot guarantee your safety. And I wanted to go anyway, so I told them I'm coming. My industry friends from Europe and North America who'd been going regularly weren't going either. So every day I would get up and I'd hear some terrible stories about kidnapping and I wasn't going to go. And then I would get an email from the festival director saying, no, you have to come, you have to come, literally begging me to come. Everyone's pulling out, you have to come. And, you know, building a relationship with me so that I wouldn't let him down. Anyhow, so I boarded the plane and via Belgium ended up in Bamako. And he had, you know, guaranteed me that there would be a car waiting for me at the airport. Of course, the car was not there. So I had the address for the hotel, so I made it to the hotel in Bamako. And about 1 a.m. in the morning, the festival director called me to apologize for the mix-up and reassured me that the chartered flight to Timbuktu would be there the next day. So the next day, I flew to Timbuktu and started having a really wonderful time at this three-day music festival. And the group that I was going to be collaborating with, Tenariwen, on the second night of the festival, they had a surprise collaboration. Someone flew all the way to the desert to collaborate with them, and that person was Bono of U2.
Well.
Yep. There he was backstage. And then the third night, I was supposed to collaborate with Tenariwen, and I was going to be we were going to be the last show of this three-day festival, and we were going to be on at midnight, and it was freezing, freezing cold
in the desert.
Desert.
Couldn't
even feel my toes, really. So we're supposed to be on at midnight, and midnight came, and midnight went. And I waited and I waited, and I took the stage at 3:40 a.m. And I was really cold, but when I got up on stage, there were 3,000 people there, and I started singing, and I heard the very, very vocal support of these 3,000 people urging me to go on and go on. And at one point, the crowd was so loud at that time of the morning even that they were so loud that I was having trouble hearing myself. And so it was a great experience, and the festival didn't happen this year because of all the political turmoil. Now Al-Qaeda has taken over a large part of the north in Mali, and they have banned music. And all the French and Malian troops are fighting them there. The situation is still volatile, and so there is no festival this year. And so they've put out, there's an agency that's put out a recording of last year's festival. So that song that I sang with Tenariwen is now on a CD that's going to be released later this month, and it's called, I think it's just called Festival au Désert Live, something like that, 2012.
Wow, that's an incredible story, and I'm thrilled to know that it's been recorded and documented in history.
Yeah.
So,
experience
right
to that part of the world.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, tell us what's next on the horizon for you. Do you have any upcoming tours or new albums and projects that we can look forward to?
Well, I am currently on tour, and so tomorrow night, as you mentioned, we're in it's our debut performance in Portland. I'm really, really looking forward to that at the Alberta Rose Theater. And then after that, we will head to Canada and continue the tour there. And then we'll be in Europe. And I'm working on the next CD, and I'll be doing some songs from the new CD in Portland as well. Like the CD that's not been recorded yet, but we'll be presenting some debut songs as well.
Fantastic. That's ghazal artist Kiran Ahluwalia joining us by phone from Seattle. You can learn more about her at her website, kiranmusic.com. She will be giving her, as she mentioned, debut performance here in Portland tomorrow, Wednesday evening, April 24th, at the Alberta Rose Theater at 8 p.m. So get your tickets early and go. You don't want to miss this wonderful show. Kiran Ahluwalia, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you, Portland, for having me.
That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks to KBOO engineer Janet Anderson. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio or tweet us at @StageNStudio. I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts. We're going out with the song we talked about earlier, Must Must by Kiran Ahluwalia, featuring the Malian group Tinaruan. This is off of her Juno Award-winning album, Am Samin, Common Ground. Thanks for listening.
Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. Author and radio show host Tom Hartman is referring to a growing movement in this country to pass a 28th Amendment to the Constitution. On Friday, April 26th at 7 p.m., Hartman returns to Portland to speak on We the People, not We the Corporations. That's at the First Unitarian Church at Southwest 12th Avenue and Main Street. He will also be speaking in Salem on Saturday, April 27th at 1 p.m. at the Grand Theater on Northeast High Street. You can refer to the KBOO Community Events page for more information or firstunitarian.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:28. Stay tuned at 11:30 for Art Focus. Host Joseph Galavan interviews Terry Hopkins about two shows on incarceration that she has curated at the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University.
I'm Joseph Galavan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week, our guest is Terry Hopkins, director and curator of the Art Gym at Merrillhurst University. Terry Hopkins has curated Julie Green's show, The Last Supper, 500 Plates, which consists of 500 hand-painted ceramic plates showing what death row prisoners ordered for their final meal. Buddy Bunting's The Prison Industrial Complex show is a series of large-scale drawings of modern American prisons. Both shows run concurrently from April 16th through May 17th. Welcome, Terry. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Thank you, Joseph.
The subject of the 500 plates, The Last Supper, is pretty amazing. Tell us what you see when you go in the gallery.
There are 500 plates, as the show title suggests. And they are installed all around the exterior walls on the inside of the gallery. So, in a way, you're surrounded by them. The Art Gym, for those who haven't been there, is a large, very high ceiling space with large arched windows. So these blue plates form kind of a band all the way around you. And then we've installed Buddy Bunting's drawings, which are range in scale from about 12 feet across to over 30 feet across on walls in the center of the gallery. So they are images of prisons, and Julie's images are of the last meals. So they're found plates that she's painted on with blue to illustrate those meals.
So these are odd plates. No, they're not matching. They're the kind of thing you might pick up at Goodwill. And they're white, and she paints in blue, so they have that kind of Delft-y kind of color scheme.
They do, so they look quite innocent and familiar, decorative even. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of something we know. And then the paintings themselves would be an illustration, say, of a steak and French fries and Coca-Cola and a baked potato, fully loaded, maybe on a plate, as requested. One plate has an apple. Other plates have, for example, in Louisiana, a lot of people wanted shrimp. In Oregon, one of the two plates shows salmon. So the plates are organized per Julie's instructions by state. We have the most plates from Texas, for example, which has had the greatest number of executions. Takes up a big wall. She has an illustrated every Last Supper request from every person on death row. She's doing about 50 plates a year, and she's been working for over 10 years, so she's up to 500 plates. But we do have 167 plates, for example, from Texas.
So she paints a picture of the actual food. So there'll be like three tacos kind of standing on edge, like you'd see in a commercial. She does pictures of like Fanta bottles and RC Cola, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, you know, they're monochrome. They're just blue, and you can see what the stuff is. They're sort of, would you say they're slightly cartoonish, or what is that effect she's going
for? They look almost
for?
Like watercolors in monochrome.
Right.
You know, so they're intentionally monochrome and not brightly colored. There's a sort of somber aspect to that. She mentioned at the gallery talk on Sunday, I thought this was very interesting, that she has done two plates for people who have been exonerated. So they're no longer on death row, and she painted those in full color.
So they got a request and then they somehow got off?
Right.
Oh, okay.
Right. You may be aware that there are things like the Innocence Project that mm-hmm. tries to see whether or not